UMH Podcast, el campus sonoro de la Universidad Miguel Hernández.
Hi everyone, welcome to A Taller Mountain, a podcast about women writers in English. This is episode 8. Instead of feeling bad, I'm Natalia Hernández, a teacher of English at the Official School of Languages in Elche. And this podcast has been born of the collaboration between the Official School's Media Center, Mediateca, and the UMH, Universidad Miguel Hernández. Instead of feeling low, get high. It's a pleasure to do this podcast and to know that you are there, listening to us. I really hope you enjoy spending this time together. Our podcasts can be found on iVoox, please subscribe, and also on the websites of the Official School of Languages and the UMH. Just play the game, you know, eventually you'll love her good. It's silly to... With us today, we have Maria Dolores, one of my guests in Season 1, with whom we talked about Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Thanks a lot for coming back, Maria Dolores.
My pleasure. It's great for me to collaborate with you in A Taller Mountain.
Today, we're going to talk about the renowned writer Maggie O'Farrell. And we're going to start with our first section, A Woman's Life. Let's get started. Maggie O'Farrell was born in Northern Ireland in 1972 and grew up in various locations across Wales and Scotland. When she was just 8 years old, she contracted encephalitis, an experience she describes is in one of the chapters of her wonderful memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am, 17 Brushes with Death. This illness did long-term damage, leaving her physically weak and sometimes unstable. Despite this childhood trauma, she attended Cambridge University, where she studied English before embarking on a career as a journalist. O'Farrell worked as a journalist both in Hong Kong and as deputy literary editor of The Independent on Sunday in London. She also taught creative writing at the University of Warwick in Coventry and Goldsmiths College in London. She has lived in Ireland, Wales, Scotland, Hong Kong and Italy. She now lives in Edinburgh with her husband and their three children. As regards her literary career, in the year 2000 she published her debut novel, After You'd Gone, and she is now the author of highly acclaimed novels such as The Hand That First Held Mine, Instructions for a Heatwave, This Must Be the Place, My Lover's Lover, and others. One of her most acclaimed novels, if not the most acclaimed, is Hamnet. Yes, Hamnet with an N, not an L, as in Hamlet. This book was named by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of the year. It also won two major prizes, the Women's Prize Fiction and the 2020 National Book Critics Circle Award. In 2022, she published The Marriage Portrait, a novel based on the short life of Lucrezia de' Medici, who, to some historians argue, may have been poisoned by her husband Alfonso II, Duke of Ferrara. This novel was shortlisted for the 2023 Women's Prize for Fiction. Maggie's novels have been Sunday Times bestsellers and altogether have sold over 1 million copies in the UK and Ireland and have been translated into 43 languages around the world. In them, she explores contrasting themes: family, loss, madness, treachery, but they all share her masterful craft and incomparable prose. I'd love to tell you something really special now. about the music you're listening to on the background. That's the song The Bends by the British band Radiohead, of which Maggie O'Farrell is a big fan. But, you know, I am a huge fan of Radiohead too. They're in fact my favorite band. So, Maggie O'Farrell is interviewed in the fantastic BBC radio programme Desert Island Discs, which I've mentioned before in another episode of A Taller Mountain. In this interview, she tells the audience an anecdote about this very song. She remembers listening to it on her CD Walkman, when she was on the Tube, that's the London Underground, when she was just 24. Heading to her first job as a journalist. And she describes this feeling of thrill and joy, since she felt she was finally going somewhere in her life with that job. And look where she is now.
Alone on an airplane, falling asleep against the window pane. My blood will thicken.
And it's time for our interview now. As I said before, with us today we have Maria Dolores, one of my students a few years ago, a fan of Maggie O'Farrell, and a dear friend now, I dare to say. Hello, Maria Dolores.
Hello.
Listen, you know, what struck me most about some of Maggie O'Farrell's work is that she takes characters, stories which have been told from a man's perspective, or where men have been traditionally been at the center. She turns everything around and makes us look through the eyes of a woman. What do you make of this?
Yeah. Maggie O'Farrell says that what interests her the most are the non-told stories. And I quote her, "The stories that are written in white are the ones that interest me."
So you mean that which has been written between the lines without ink in white, yes?
Exactly. In both The Marriage Portrait and Hamnet, O'Farrell finds her soft spot in the 16th century and her subject in women whose stories have been overshadowed by men's. In Hamnet, it was Shakespeare's wife, Anne, and in The Marriage Portrait is Lucrezia, the third daughter of Cosimo de' Medici, Cosimo I of Medici, ruler of Florence. In the former, she tells that after having discovered, thanks to an inspirational literature teacher, about the existence of Shakespeare and Anne's son, Hamnet, she did some research about him, and she did find scary information, probably because in those days children weren't taken into consideration as much as they are nowadays. We can't turn a blind eye to the high rates of infant mortality between 0 and 12 years old, approximately at that time.
So Hamnet was Shakespeare's son then. He did exist.
That's right. Well, after this discovery, she felt that this story should be told and that it would be through the eyes of his mother, Anne Hathaway, a woman who didn't meet the expectations society had on women and whose relevant role in Shakespeare's family hasn't always been acknowledged by scholars or biographers. In fact, this has been the reason why Maggie O'Farrell decided to write this story from her point of view.
You know, I love the fact that the novel challenges the assumptions that put Shakespeare at the center of narratives. You know, there's lots of literature and films where he's the main or a one of the characters, you know, like Shakespeare in Love, for example. Instead, she focuses on other members of the family and how they are affected by what he does, especially but by what he doesn't do. And I love that. Well, who's Hamnet in this novel, Maria Dolores? Could you expand on this a little bit?
Sure. Very few people knew about the existence of Hamnet, William Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway's son. Also, Hamnet had a twin sister, Judith, and they had another daughter, Susanna. Maggie O'Farrell points out that since the very moment she knew about his existence, she felt eager to delve in depth into him. She also learned that the names Hamnet and Hamlet were the same at that time and could be used indistinctly.
Oh, that's curious.
It really is. In fact, that made her think about the possible relationship between William Shakespeare's son's name and the title of one of his most acclaimed masterpieces. But it has never been proven with real facts.
Yes.
In Hamnet, the author tells us the story of William Shakespeare's family, although this time the main character is his wife. And it is from her own view that the family life is told. The book moves back and forth between the backstory of how Anne and Shakespeare met and got married, and how Hamnet's death and their subsequent grief affected them, each in their own way. Oh. William Shakespeare's name, albeit present throughout the novel, is never mentioned. In fact, Maggie O'Farrell deliberately omits his name, and this is what makes the story so attractive.
Yeah, it's even symbolic. I would say that his name is never mentioned.
Yes. In the novel, we get immersed in the day-to-day life of an Elizabethan ordinary family, but above all, in the grief a mother feels when death is menacing her child. We are talking about fiction, however. The exhaustive investigation the author does before writing is what I admire the most. She, Maggie O'Farrell, visited Stratford-upon-Avon, the town where Shakespeare was born. She interviewed people, walked around the places she sets her work in, to feel and sense as Anne Hathaway would have done in that moment. He researched in archives and documents found in the chart are examples of to what extent she wanted to be as precise as possible in the language used in her descriptions and literary devices according to those days. It is simply admirable. So it is not a surprise that Anne Hathaway is a superb character, a free-spirited and strong-minded woman who grabs our attention for being so brave and resolute when she has to take the responsibility of her family while her husband is mostly absent. The objective of highlighting this woman, so ignored and misunderstood through centuries, is by far and away accomplished by the author.
It is, yes. And in relation to what you've just said, betrayal is a main topic here. William, with the intention or the excuse to expand his family business, goes to London after making a promise to his wife to take her with him as soon as the daughter becomes healthy. But what he really does in London is establish his career as a playwright. He tells his wife that he's saving money to buy a house, but that never happens. Then After the son's death, he is reluctant to go back home. And very soon, too, she realizes that he's been with other women or people.
Yes. If truth be told, the idea of betrayal in Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway's marriage has always been flying in the air. However, despite the long periods of time they were separated, they never broke their bond. Certainly, it is a matter that has been under speculation by scholars and historians. Oi. Nevertheless, there is a lack of evidence to define the exact nature of William Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway's relationship. Unfortunately, infidelity in Elizabethan society was considered as part and parcel of being a man. So, accepted or forgiven, there are some real facts which make us think that somehow they took each other into some consideration. For instance, the fact that they were buried in the same place, or that Shakespeare kept his wife in his will.
Yes.
Betrayal is also portrayed when in the novel, Agnes, Shakespeare's wife, real name, feels that her husband is taking advantage of their son's death when he gives the name Hamlet to his husband's most successful play.
Grief is another of the main topics in the novel. Can you comment on this, please?
Yeah. With respect to grief, the author approaches this topic from another angle as we watch Agnes's way of life. Her rituals and rites clash with the world around her.
Yes, I'd like to mention here that in the novel, she comes across as a woman who's intimately connected to nature, doesn't she? To some pre-Christian rites or pagan religion, like a witch, really?
She certainly does. And the painful reality of the novel is to be walked through Agnes's memories as the story moves inexorably toward loss. Calling the first intimation of his absence, I quote here, life's epicenter from which everything flows out, to which everything returns. And the novel follows her reflection down many special moments. Hamlet and his twin sister Judith's birthday, meeting Hamlet's father, the mourning of her son's death, and we watch her remember as she practices mourning rituals, taking a lock of Hamlet's hair and storing it over the mantle, refusing to move his clothing, constantly watching and listening to his footsteps, experiencing awareness of his absence. This level of grief, like Hamlet, is always uncomfortable for those around her. Agnes's mother-in-law, who has buried three children, sees it as too much, and her husband flees from Stratford-upon-Avon to go to London, partially to escape her overwhelming everyday grief.
To me, this is key in the novel. Not just his absence, you know, but his escape. He escapes. He avoids everything. In other words, to me, it's his cowardice. Not only does he avoid the situation following his wish to become a playwright, but he abandons his children and his wife.
Yeah. Then in the final pages, we watch Agnes's remembrance and grief transform her relationship with her husband, her understanding of herself and what she can do now, even in how she occupies space. This transformation can itself seem a tragedy. In the first year after her son's death, Agnes reflects that she is not the person she used to be. She has changed fundamentally. These changes include suspending her healing practice, for instance. Moreover, the novel also shows the painful reality that transformation and remembrance go hand in hand.
I did love Hamnet, I did. But now let us turn to her last published novel, The Marriage Portrait. I know, Maria Dolores, that you felt really moved when you found out how she got inspired to write this novel. You found it out, since I had no clue this had happened, and you told me, remember? I'd now love you to tell our listeners, please.
Yes. It was something which really touched me. The author had been reading Robert Browning's dramatic dialogues, and she was wondering whether the context of My Last Duchess, one of his poems, was real. In this Gothic poem, a Renaissance despot, a tyrannical ruler, recounts how he strangled the young wife whose picture still hangs on his wall. She wanted to know if that portrait existed or not, and eventually she found it on the internet.
Okay.
So striking was Lucrezia de Medici's portrait that she knew what her next novel was going to be. Maggie O'Farrell spent a long time trying to find the real physical portrait somewhere in the Uffizi Gallery, where there is a room only for the Medici.
Mm-hmm.
She had three art scholars who helped her, but they couldn't find it. Mm. One of them thought that it could be in the Palazzo Pitti, and with a printout of the portrait, she went there, showed it to all the guards, but none of them had seen it before. Eventually, she found it in a room next to a fire extinguisher. That was really sad for the author,
sad.
Who asked herself why Lucrezia was there alone instead of being with her family. Maggie O'Farrell wanted to imagine a story that Lucrezia de Medici might have told had she been given the chance.
So there is another woman whose story has been lost, or fortunately, nearly lost this time. Like the stories of so many women whose value has never been acknowledged, whose violent death or whose stories of aggressions or abuse have been ignored. Could you now tell us a bit about the plot of the novel, briefly?
The story is about the previously arranged marriage between Alfonso II of Ferrara and Lucrezia, the third daughter of Cosimo I of Medici. She was 13 years old when their betrothal took place, and they had to wait for 3 years until the moment of womanhood arrived.
Yes, they had to wait for her to get her first period, right, in order to get married.
Exactly. Although Lucrezia wasn't the first option for this marriage, it was her elder sister, but she died. So as part of an arranged trade, she had to play her role. Alfonso of Ferrara was obsessed with having an heir. And the fact that Lucrezia couldn't get pregnant created a resentful atmosphere between them. She knows he intends to murder her, and we as readers empathize with the young girl who is living a sad and isolated life from which she hopes to break free.
So she was being forced into pregnancy, but since it wasn't working, she had to disappear. She had to be murdered. Okay, to introduce my next question, I'd like to use a quote from the novel. The setting, you have to imagine, you must imagine, at this moment is her wedding night, in bed with Alfonso. And the quote goes like this. Let's remember, she's a girl of 13 years old. This is the quote. She curls up her toes inside her slippers and repeats to herself Sophia's advice on the matter of her wedding night. Let the man do what he will. Don't fight or struggle. Breathe deeply and it will soon be over. But it is not, she had wanted to say to Sofia, in my nature to acquiesce, to submit. That was like striking for me. Violence against women, a girl in this case, let's not forget that, is one of the central topics in this novel. What do you think of this, Maria Dolores?
Well, the marriage portrait is totally against the dynastic system that produces a child bride. O'Farrell has written an effective feminist account of the trauma of political marriages for inexperienced girls who have no notion of love and know only obedience or duty.
That can only be defined as a monstrous law, a monstrous tradition.
Of course. The novel reflects that in the eyes of her contemporaries, Lucrezia was considered an adult, ready to for obligations that came with being a domestic wife. Assuming this, although sad, we can understand the way in which Lucrezia reacts and thinks or feels in her wedding night, something which had a total lack of tenderness, love, intimacy, or thoughtfulness. Even the fact that men could satisfy their sexual desire without caring for their partners was something universally accepted. However, and incredible though it may seem, recently, on the 21st or 23rd of January this year, a new law was passed in Iraq, which allows girls of 9 years old to legally get married. So, in this day and age, we are still at the starting point when it comes to women's rights. Suffice to say that for those girls, their wedding night will be even worse than the one of Lucrezia Medici. That's absolutely unacceptable.
I would describe this law, though, as a law which allows men to rape girls, something that should be done away with, and it's inhumane. To me, this novel is an allegation against the rape of girls. This traditional and widely accepted custom, which still prevails in countries like not only Iraq, I've done some research, but many others like India, Chad, Mali, or Niger, where this last one, Niger, where 76% of married women were married before they were 18 years old. That most girls have been raped and married forcefully. I do wonder how the so-called Western countries would feel, or what we would do if it was boys being raped like this.
It's crazy. How come this is still happening in the 21st century?
Now we are about to wrap up, Maria Dolores, and it's time for me to ask you the two questions I ask all my interviewees, my guests. Let's get started. Do you have a favorite quote by Maggie O'Farrell?
Yes, I've got a favorite quote by her. I'll read it for you. It's this. The leaves crisping at their edges. There is a season Hamnet has not known or touched. There is a world moving on without him. It's very short, but I think it's nice.
It's really nice.
I could have chosen many other quotes by Maggie O'Farrell since she wisely knows how to describe the feelings of a woman. But I find that this one reflects with mastery and precision the immense emptiness that the loss of a child provokes in a mother, and how painful and incredible at the same time it is to witness that the world is going on as if nothing has happened, when she feels that for her something deep inside has stopped forever.
I can't even imagine having to go through something like that. Okay, the last one. Now, would you recommend reading her work to students of English and or to everyone?
Without any shadow of a doubt, I highly recommend reading Maggie O'Farrell's work. Not only are you going to enjoy her witty and agile way of writing, but you are also going to feel immersed in her stories due to the sensitivity and vividness of her poetic narrative, which makes you be so close to the characters in her novels. Obviously, I wouldn't recommend reading her work to beginner students of English, but I totally do for those with an intermediate or high level of English.
Okay, that was really useful. Thank you. Thanks so much, Maria Dolores. It's been lovely to have you here.
Thanks to you.
And now, it's time for our next section, On Screen. Of course, she has an official website. You can't miss it. That's maggieofarrell.com. I'll never, never tire of recommending the great BBC radio program Desert Island Discs. Listen to her interview on this fantastic program. If you can spare 10 minutes of your time, watch another interview with her on France 24 English, where she talks about her wonderful memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am. If you'd like to read an excerpt of Hamnet to decide if you'd want to read it or not, you can find an extract online. I'll leave you the link. In April 2023, the Royal Shakespeare Company's stage adaptation of Hamnet previewed at the newly opened Swan Theatre in Stratford-upon-Avon, which transferred to London in September 2023. At the moment, Hamnet is being adapted for the screen by the Chinese director Chloe Zhao, also the director of the Oscar-winning Nomadland, alongside O'Farrell. Paul Mescal and Jesse Buckley have been chosen for the leading roles. In May 2024, a French director, Audrey Diwan, was attached to direct a film adaptation of The Marriage Portrait. Before we go, I'd love you, Maria Dolores, to read Legacy to our listeners and to me, of course, the poem by Rupi Kaur, which inspired the name of this podcast. Will you do that for us, please? You know I love listening to you.
Of course, I'll read it for you. I stand on the sacrifices of a million women before me, thinking, what can I do to make this mountain taller so the women after me can see farther?
That was lovely. Thanks again. You've made this mountain taller today with us doing this podcast. Our listeners too. All of us together, we're making this mountain taller. And that was all for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and please tune in next month for episode 9.
Instead of feeling bad, be glad you got somewhere.
You'll find the link to this podcast, as well as those links I mentioned in the section on screen, posted on the Instagram page of the Official School of Languages and in the description of the episode on iVoox. Subscribe, please, and don't forget to give us a like if you enjoyed it. It'll also be available on the school's website and on UMH Radio.
Feel good about what you're dreaming of. Instead of trying to win.
Thanks to all of you for listening, to you, Maria Dolores, for joining us, and to the entire staff of UMH Radio. In the technical team today, Antonio Peñalver. Bye.
love you don't own. Just let her be your woman and you'll be her man. Instead of feeling broke.
UMH Podcast, el campus sonoro de la Universidad Miguel Hernández.